and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Russia's defense ministry yesterday said that Turkey could be preparing an invasion of Syria. Turkey also canceled an observation flight by Russia over its territory in violation of the Open Skies Treaty. With Syrian peace talks having collapsed in Geneva on Wednesday, will there be an escalation in the conflict? The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, has been signed by ministers from 12 countries involved in the pact amid protests in the streets from New Zealand to Washington, D.C. We are joined today by Tom Hartman, author and host of The Tom Hartman Show, to talk about the TPP. And we are joined from London by the WikiLeaks spokesperson to talk about the UN panel's decision in favor of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been holed up for 3.5 years in the Embassy of Ecuador in London. But first, we turn to Syria, the possibility of an even wider regional war. Russia's defense ministry yesterday said that Turkey could be preparing an invasion of Syria. Turkey also canceled observation flights by Russia over its territory in violation of the Open Skies Treaty. With Syrian peace talks having collapsed in Geneva on Wednesday, will there be another escalation in this conflict? We are joined by Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity and by Erman Çetin, who writes for the newspaper Sol, S-O-L, in Turkey. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, thank you.
Erman, let me start with you. The Russians are saying that they believe that the Turkish government and the Turkish military may be preparing for a military intervention directly into Syria. From your point of view, in Turkey, do you think that this is possible?
Yes, we expect a military escalation in Syria because our President Erdogan consumed his alternatives for Syria. What does that mean? I mean that in northern Aleppo, Syrian government and its allies cut the rebels' main supply line, which comes from Turkey to central Aleppo. So the Turkish government's main buffer zone plan contains northern Aleppo from Azaz to Mareya to Cerablus. So the Turkish-backed jihadists in northern Aleppo now, they have not any supply line from Turkey to Aleppo. So if you ask me, under normal circumstances, Turkey must pull back from Syria and must reduce its interventionist policy towards Syria. But President Erdogan dreaming to conquer a part of Syria, and also he waging a war against his own Kurds.
Erman, let me also bring in Daniel McAdams into the conversation. Daniel, Erman is suggesting, I believe, that the Turkish military intervention, which the Russians are warning about, into Syria, an obvious escalation, is because jihadist rebels who are getting weapons and funds and support from Turkey have become isolated. In other words, it appears to be a tactical move to support its allies who are trying to overthrow the Assad government. Is it possible, or do you think it's likely, that this is a precursor to a larger, even more complicated situation in Syria? And of course, comment, if you would, about the collapse of the Geneva peace talks.
Well, the collapse of the talks now are supposedly, at least according to Reuters and the State Department, they're blamed on Russia for Russia's continued bombing of Syria. This is the line that they're taking. But I think the reality is that the U.S. and Turkey and the other various allies are having an absolute panic attack over the very dramatic advances over the last couple of days. If you remember when the U.S. started intervening, Russia was supposed to be getting bogged down in Syria. They would never reach any goals. The U.S. strategy has been to use the U.N. talks to carve out some political space for the opposition. And they appeared to have won a concession a couple of days ago in bringing some of the more extremist groups in to be sitting down at the table. But to carve out this this area for them to achieve a one-way ceasefire, and we saw this in Serbia back in 1999, you'll remember, a one-way ceasefire where every violation will be blamed on Assad and the other side will be ignored. And then to get a UN resolution to enforce the ceasefire, at which time you would allow Turkish and other troops to enter. Well, that has not come to pass as it was planned. And I think now we're seeing a scramble for what to do. And that's why you're seeing, for example, Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the UN today, tweeting about how we need a political solution. This all of a sudden, Kerry asking Russia, please stop bombing in Syria. So I don't think they know what to do. Fact of the matter is, if Turkey were to have a major ground invasion of Syria, regardless of whether they claim it'll be under the responsibility to protect, which was what was used in Libya, whether they claim that or not, the fact of the matter is this will be such a dramatic escalation. It could not be taken without the explicit okay of Washington and NATO. And in that case, it means that Washington is prepared to get to the very, very brink of World War III with Russia over Syria. That is very frightening.
Yes. Ermenchete from Turkey, let me ask you this. The Turkish government, of course, Turkey is part of NATO, NATO's eastern flank. But is Erdogan, from your point of view, is the Turkish move that we are now anticipating, military move directly into Syria, is it with the support of the United States? Is it done on behalf of the United States? Or is Turkey doing this independently of the United States in spite of the fact that it is a principal and important part of NATO? What do you think?
Yeah, first of all, Erdogan is trying to create an escalation between NATO or the United States and Russia. So because he a kind of trap he creates for both Turkey and Syria and the United States. So Erdogan is trapped and he wants an escalation between NATO and Russia. So he sees the point that his main salvation from the Syria and also the inside the inner politics of Turkey to wage a war against a foreign enemy. He calls.
So let me ask you then. So let's just think about these scenarios. I'll ask both of you. Turkey moves in with military ground forces. It appears that they're clearing mines right now in parts of Syria that. Preparing for Turkish military troops to enter. Now, we know that Russia is deeply involved in an air attack on terrorist units, ISIL and others, Al-Qaeda, Nusra, Army of Conquest, others perhaps. If the Russians strike Turkish forces and Turkey strikes back, or vice versa, then you have a situation in which NATO, the Turkey is a member of NATO, calls on the rest of NATO as a condition, as a treaty condition, that once one member of NATO has been attacked or harmed or threatened, the rest of NATO powers have to come to their aid. Daniel McAdams, that's what Ermenchete is suggesting, that Turkey is actually setting a trap to draw NATO into a larger confrontation with Russia, both for its own domestic political purposes and because of its standing inside of Syria. What do you think?
I still think that that Turkey would not do this without the explicit permission of Washington. I think the scenario that you outlined, it would be very much dependent on the Russian response. That's A. If there are small tactical skirmishes, I think they could be set aside. And I also think that, I wonder about Article 5 of NATO Treaty, because if Turkey undertakes an aggressive invasion of Syria and finds itself in a conflict in that circumstance, I wonder about the applicability of Article 5. However, if you see a massive retaliation from the Russians on Turkish territory, then I think it would be much more of a slam dunk in that case. So I think it all depends.
Explain what Article 5 is for our listeners.
Article 5, I'm sorry, is the mutual defense aspect of the NATO treaty. That is where if one NATO member is attacked, the other countries are obligated within their legal structure to come to the aid of that country. So whether that would be tripped in small tactical skirmishes on Syrian territory, I think it's an open question. But if there is a massive retaliation from Russia for a Turkish invasion, I mean, the Russians have been at least implicitly assisting the Kurds in that region as well. And that has, of course, the Turks in a state of panic as well. So, absolutely, I think it becomes a much more dangerous situation. How far does it go? I don't think anyone knows. And I wonder if anyone in Washington has played this out to where it may end up.
I mean, we're just 101 and a half years after the start of World War I. Big mistakes were made by all sides as the world economic and political system shifted. What do you think, Armand? I mean, is it possible that we are on the precipice of a NATO-Russian confrontation inside of Syria as a consequence of Turkey's actions?
Well, I don't think so. I agree with Daniel, because the United States, the White House, is not seek for an escalation with Syria, with Russia in Syria. Plus, the Turkey's actions is not applicable by the United States in Syria, because they support Kurds. They have an approachment with Russia about the political solution in Syria. So I don't think so. They want a World War III in Syria because of the Turkish government.
Well, I didn't mean because the United States wanted World War III. I certainly agree with you that they don't. But once this sort of situation begins, once the escalation ladder is climbed, Turkey goes into Syria. Russia is saying right now that even the violation of the Open Skies Treaty by Ankara, whereby they would not allow, as they were required to by international law with the Open Skies Treaty, to allow a Russian plane into their airspace, the cancellation of that, the Russians are treating this as a serious provocation. If there is a military clash between Turkey, a NATO member, and Russia, even if it's inadvertent, even if it's not a deliberate plan, certainly by Washington, doesn't it automatically escalate?
I think the domestic situation in Turkey prevents this escalation. A total war, the grand war, a kind of huge escalation is not expected. But because of the Erdogan's dreams, let me say, so he tries to convince his allies, his Western allies, about his presidential gains, and in domestic situation is escalating in our southeastern part of the country. So if the Turkish government starts a war in Syria, the domestic situation in Turkey also escalates, not only in the southeastern part of Turkey, the western part of Turkey also. A large part of the Turkish community, is against any kind of war against Syria.
Daniel McAdams, the Airman is saying the people of Turkey don't want a wider war, and certainly I would agree that Washington hasn't decided that it wants a wider war. You believe that Turkey would not be doing this without at least the complicity of Washington. Let's turn to another part of this very complex situation, which is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has also, like Turkey, been a lifeline for jihadist forces, for ISIL forces, for Al-Qaeda forces, with money and funding and political support. And now Saudi Arabia, as the Geneva peace talks seem to be coming apart or have come apart, Saudi Arabia, too, is saying that they are prepared to militarily intervene in Syria. Is that credible?
Yeah, I think this is, at least this adds a little bit of comedy to our discussion, which I think in such serious topics, we need a little bit of comedy. Saudi Arabia has had a disaster on its hands ever since it decided to start bombing Yemen. The Saudi Arabian ground forces in Yemen have met their match and then some. As a matter of fact, they have been so inadequate on the battlefield, they had to import 10,000 Sudanese mercenaries to do their fighting for them. Their economy is a disaster. It's absolutely shrinking. Their oil gamble in trying to bankrupt Russia has fallen flat and blown up in their faces. So the idea that Saudi Arabia is going to send some of its perfumed princes over to invade Syria, I think at least we get a little bit of a laugh out of hearing this.
Okay, so you don't consider that to be credible. What about the fact that the peace talks have broken down? I'll ask either of you this question. The Russian intervention seems to me to have irreversibly changed the military dynamic, because it's now quite clear that the Syrian Arab Army, the government-led army, the army led by the government of Bashar al-Assad, will not be overthrown. The Russians came in and said the Syrian Arab Army is an indispensable part of the struggle to defeat ISIL. So they have reinforcements. There's a process been set up in which there could be negotiations, a possible ceasefire, eventually an election for a new government or a government chosen by the Syrian people. But right now, the peace talks have broken apart. In the last 90 seconds, I want to ask each of you for about 45 seconds. Erman, first to you, is there a possibility for any kind of resolution in Syria other than the continuation of the war?
I think to reach a political solution in Syria, Turkey and Saudi Arabia must be eliminated. So because these two countries right now are preventing a peaceful solution in Syria. So if the United States and Russia want to reach a political solution, a peaceful solution in Syria, these two governments either must be convinced or, let me say, overthrown.
Okay. Daniel McAdams, I want to let you have the final word on the same question, if I could.
Sure. I think the failure of the peace talks, so-called failure of the peace talks, has exposed the fact that there are no moderate rebel forces in Syria. This was a fiction that the U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the others have been putting forth for so long. And in desperation, you saw the U.S. and the Saudis trying to put forth al-Qaeda's allies in the peace talks. There is nothing to discuss with people like al-Qaeda, who are supposed to be our enemies. I don't think the solution, as far as how it's being organized through the UN, is a dead-end street.
Okay, we are out of time. Thanks to both of you, Daniel McAdams and Erman Çetey. Daniel McAdams is with the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Erman Çetey writes for the newspaper Sol, S-O-L, in Turkey. Thanks so much. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Ministers from 12 countries accounting for 40% of the world's economy gathered in Auckland, New Zealand to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, yesterday. Each country now has 2 years to ratify or reject the pact. The TPP continues to face opposition from protesters. They were in the streets yesterday in New Zealand and in Washington, D.C., and they're in the streets across the globe. We are joined by Tom Hartmann, author and host of The Tom Hartmann Show. Thank you.
Brian, great to have you with great. I'm so used to
it's understandable.
Great to be with you.
And we're here in your studios.
Indeed.
Tom, Bernie Sanders said, let's be clear, the TPP is much more than a free trade agreement. It's part of a global race to the bottom to boost the profits of the large corporations and Wall Street by outsourcing jobs, undercutting worker rights, dismantling labor, environmental health, food safety, and financial laws. Is Bernie Sanders right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's not only right, he's absolutely right. This goes back to a kind of change in thinking that has always been, you know, there's always been this strain of this in American politics, but American protectionism was really big at the beginning of the country, you know, through the Civil War. You know, Andrew Jackson, it was a kind of a cornerstone of his presidency, Abraham Lincoln and so forth. And then in the late 19th century, as America started, you know, really started manufacturing things and the Industrial Revolution came along, this idea of exploiting global markets for both raw materials, you know, let's go mine Honduras and Guatemala for cheap labor and fruit, and let's take over Hawaii and all this kind of this kind of semi weird imperialistic globalism took hold in America. And with the Nixon administration, it took another shift. And that was, you know, he was basically being paid off by Pepsi, is my recollection, to try to open China as a market for them, which he did. He went over there and he brought Pepsi to China. And that was
Coke had the Soviet Union, so Pepsi had to get China.
Was that it? Yeah, I'm not a super student of this story, other than that was the point in time when it became acceptable in the Republican Party. And it had been on and off over the previous 50 years of the Democratic Party, which had been swinging back and forth between, you know, Dixiecrats, Southern conservatives, and Northern elites. But it became acceptable in the Republican Party to talk about a non-nationalist foreign economic policy. That is to say, let's do trade in ways that are good for General Motors, but not necessarily best for America. But it was still being sold to us as what's best for GM is what's best for America. What's best in the case of Nixon, what's best for Pepsi is best for America. And, you know, Nixon sort of cracked that door open and really got the meme rolling. Reagan picked up steam with it. And it was Bill Clinton who just blew the doors out, you know, with NAFTA, GATT, and the World Trade Organization that came out of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. And that belief, and it's a belief. I mean, it's a religion that, you know, it's a new world. There are new economic rules. Adam Smith, be damned. I mean, Adam Smith in 1776 in Wealth of Nations, people talk as if he invented economics. He didn't. I mean, he was repeating stuff Aristotle had written. He was codifying it. He was, you know, articulating it in the language of the day. But this was a whole brand new idea. We don't need nation states anymore. Or if we do have nation states, the only reason that we have them is for nationality, not for, in other words, you know, okay, these people with these genetics live here and these people with these genetics live there. But we don't need to have nation states that protect each other, or protect themselves rather, economically. And that fallacy who was that cranky billionaire, Ross Perot, pointed out so cogently in that 1992 election, and I'm guessing you remember as well as I do, that was a big deal, and Perot was absolutely right. But we still, as a nation, we're just starting to wake up out of that.
So what are the basic features of the TPP that make it so bad? I mean, what are the critical elements that are? Is it really a free trade agreement? Many people are calling it an investor's agreement, an investor's bill of rights, that the investors, that the corporations have now paramount powers over government, et cetera, over environmental laws, over workers' rights. How do you see it?
Well, free trade agreement is an oxymoron. If it's free trade, then you don't need an agreement. Right? If it's completely unregulated, then there's no regulations. There's no agreement. So this is highly managed trade. But it's not just highly managed trade out of the, 30 some odd chapters, high 20s, I forget the exact number of the TPP. Only five or six of them have to do with actual trade. And this is the most toxic and, frankly, in my opinion, destructive part of the TPP is not just destructive to our economy. You know, we're going to continue to see more job losses. We just had, I think it was the Economic Policy Institute just came out a day before yesterday to contradict the Peterson Institute. Pete Peterson, you know, the Wall Street billionaire who's spent $500 million trying to privatize Social Security in the last decade, came out and said, oh, the TPP is going to be wonderful. Well, no, other economists are saying, no, it's going to lead to job losses and all that. But that's only a small piece of the story. I mean, other trade agreements have done that as well. What it is essentially surrendering sovereignty and small d democracy. We are saying now that if Congress passes a law and to say, protect you and me, Brian, from an oil-fired or a coal-fired power plant down the street so that, you know, the doesn't poison us. Congress passes that law, and that power plant happens to be owned by a Chinese company or by a Malaysian company, or China's not yet a signatory, but they probably will be, or a Brunei company or a Mexican company or whatever. And they can sue, not you and me, but they can sue our government, whether our government is the city of Washington, D.C., or the state of Washington, the District of Columbia, or, you know, in a larger state, it would be, you know, Lansing, Michigan, or the state of Michigan, or whether it's the federal government. They can sue us and recover from us the amount of money they would have made in profits if we had not stopped them from killing us, you know, from Amazing. Polluting us. And that is a complete surrender of a nation's sovereignty. And that's wrong. I mean, that's just fundamentally wrong. We, you know, the lawmakers of this country are supposed to represent us. And now we have this situation, you know, with the TPP. And frankly, you know, this has happened under NAFTA. In fact, it just happened a couple of months ago under NAFTA. And, you know, where they come in and they say, oh, you can't have, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, that sort of thing. And well, the country of origin labeling, for example. Congress passed a law at the behest of the people. I mean, you know, the Republicans were actually opposed to this in large part, passed a law saying that if meat is sold in the United States, it has to be labeled with the country of origin if it's outside the United States. Sounds like sense. 90% of consumers want it. You know, Congress finally passed it. And what happens? Mexico and Canada sue us under the NAFTA tribunals and say you can't have that law. And so we had to change our own law because we were paying $1 billion a week penalty to NAFTA, to the NAFTA tribunal, for lost profits from these. I mean, this is crazy stuff.
So it's a NAFTA tribunal. So let's talk about the tribunals. Let's talk about the courts of, by, and for the people, a jury by your peers. Who are the courts? Like, if you have a NAFTA court, who will be the TPP court? And it's true not just for American government being sued or local government being sued by a corporation, but vice versa. The United States can go to Mexico and say, well, there's some law in Chiapas, for instance, that protects farmers in Mexico, although that got pretty much wiped out with NAFTA, but some existing law.
No, we did that with NAFTA to protect GMO, to help out the GMO companies down there to dump our corn. And we wiped out, you know, a million Mexican farmers.
Yeah, the indigenous farmers got wiped out. The Zapatista Rebellion that started in January 94, which was when NAFTA came into existence, they said NAFTA is a death sentence for Indian people.
And it was.
And it was.
So the way the tribunals work, and this was established with NAFTA. There's another one from the World Trade Organization. They have their own tribunals, the WTO. And each one of these trade agreements, the South Korean Free Trade Agreement, the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, they all have these tribunals. And the tribunals are set up. They are supposedly judicial. I would say they're extrajudicial. They're supposedly legal. I'd say they're extra legal. They're not legal. It's a three-person tribunal. Those three people are lawyers. Those lawyers are also the lawyers who take turns representing the corporations who are suing the countries. The countries' lawyers don't serve on the tribunals, but the corporate lawyers do. So the tribunal will be made up of three lawyers who represent corporations and very often are lobbyists as well. And they're ultimately making the decision. And then, you know, one of their colleagues and friends, who next week will be a tribunal member rather than a lawyer, you know, they take turns, is going to be arguing against you and me, against the United States. And then the United States has to go in and defend itself. And you're correct. It could be other countries as well. And an American industry could sue other companies. And that's actually, in particular with the entertainment industry, what they're envisioning is, you know, they've got these intellectual property rights, and Disney wants to be able to sue anybody who shows a picture of the mouse and, you know, that kind of thing. And so they're chomping at the bit to sue other companies, you know, or other countries. But basically, it's a lockdown of the world economic system by, well, in the case of TPP, it's 40% of the world's economy in 12 countries. You add that to NAFTA, you add that to the WTO, you add that to CAFTA, you know, SHAFTA, all the rest of them. And, you know, we don't have democracy anymore. We don't have political democracy anymore, and we don't have economic democracy anymore. And that's the bad news. The good news is Donald Trump is saying this is BS and nonsense, forgive my phrase, but I think we can say that on the radio. And Bernie Sanders is saying the same thing. It's like, and the American people are going, you know, we thought Trump was crazy, but yeah, he's right. And, you know, we thought Bernie was a socialist, but yeah, he's right. And these, I think, frankly, this is the issue that is the most potent issue. And, yeah, I mean, Ross Perot got 22% of the vote, as I recall, back in 92. Right. I'd say right now he'd get 50% of the vote.
And interestingly, President Obama, who was the true champion of this TPP, who said it was his top legislative priority in 2016, when it came time to give his final State of the Union address, which happened in January, he spent exactly 28 seconds on the TPP. And it just made me wonder that and I'd like you to explain it to the audience, because we have a global audience in addition to a U.S. audience. The TPP agreement was produced essentially in secret. It was fast-tracked, meaning no amendments allowed. And then popular opposition started building and building and building. Do you think that President Obama now feels that it's possible that the TPP could be defeated based on popular opposition?
Yeah, I do. In 2008, and we've got the video floating around here someplace, President Obama was speaking to the AFL-CIO, and he said, candidate Obama, and he said, first of all, he was asked about NAFTA, and he said, NAFTA is a flawed deal. The first thing I'll do when I become president is call in the presidents of Mexico and Canada, and we'll renegotiate NAFTA so it doesn't screw the American worker. Well, he didn't do that. And then he said, he turned to the AFL-CIO guys, and he said, in any future trade agreements that are negotiated in my administration, you guys are going to be at the table. Organized labor is going to be at the table. AFL-CIO was locked out of this. All labor was locked out of this. These negotiations were conducted exclusively by trade representatives like Michael Froman, who's Obama's trade representative, who's a former corporate lobbyist, and exclusively corporate lobbyists, hundreds of them. And you know, it was entirely negotiated by them.
So they were at the table, and Congress people could not see the...
Could not even read it. That's right. And there was a media blackout. There was a congressional blackout. But to your point of the 28 seconds, here's what I find really fascinating. 2 years ago, President Obama, in his State of the Union address, mentioned the TPP. And virtually all the Republicans and a smattering of Democrats stood up and applauded him. Last year, Obama, in his State of the Union address, mentioned the TPP. And maybe very few Democrats stood up. Most of the Republicans stood up. This time, when he mentioned TPP, go back and look at the video. The only people who stood up were the members of his cabinet. That was it. No standing ovation. That's how fast public opinion has changed in America. And that's why I think that this thing might be in trouble. And that's why they're trying to slip this through in the dark of night. They signed this thing in Auckland yesterday, and it didn't even, you know, the New York Times didn't even bother to report on it, to the best of my knowledge. I'm sure they did, but, you know, I didn't see it. I read the paper every day. I didn't see it on any of the networks. I didn't, you know, it's like it's invisible.
From your point of view, what is the motivator for President Obama? Here he is, beleaguered by the Republicans. He could have said, if he said it was dark, they'd say it's light. If he said A, they'd say B. Nothing President Obama could do in the last 7 years wouldn't be met by absolute opposition by the Republican Party. But although they may have been drifting away in terms of their support for the TPP, they were his allies. I'm just wondering, from your point of view, what drove President Obama to put such a high stakes embrace of the TPP, in spite of the fact that the Democratic Party in the main didn't support it, and working people, the unions, the traditional base of the Democratic Party, 100% or almost 100% opposed it. What drove him to it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the man, and I don't know what's in his heart. The speculation, there are a variety of types of speculation. One is, you know, Bill Clinton left office, what, $20 million in debt from all his legal fees and things? He's worth over $100 million now. Barack Obama might like to do the same. And the people who can make him $100 million are the ones who are pushing for the TPP. That's one possibility. It's very cynical. Another one is, you know, he was elected president of the United States twice. That took several billion dollars. You don't get several billion dollars from big corporations without offering them something in exchange. This may be what the deal was. Might have been explicit, might have been implicit, but there it is. That's a little less cynical, but, you know, hey, it's American politics. The third option, which is pretty much not at all cynical, but kind of sad, is that Al Fromm, there's a book over here about Al Fromm, you know, how he in 87 made a pilgrimage down to Arkansas to talk to Governor Clinton and said, you know, I've got this idea for a bloodless coup in the Democratic Party. We'll take over the party. You know, we'll get in bed with some of the more friendly corporations, not the sick, toxic ones like the tobacco industry. We'll go with the banks. You know, they do good stuff and they have, their hands are clean, right? And reinvent the Democratic Party as the corporatist party. And therefore, the Democratic Party's theology now, from 92 until today, has been, at least for those people who consider themselves third way Democrats or DLC Democrats or New Democrats, the Harold Ford Juniors, the list goes on, right? The Barbara Mikulskis, the Mary Landrews, and you see how that worked out for her. They're saying free trade must be a good thing. What's good for Microsoft is good for America. What's good for the mouse is good for America, and so it may be that this was the triumph of ideology. I've even had one person who works in the White House make the comment to me off the record, but a pretty good source, that in their opinion, Michael Froman, who is the trade negotiator and the trade representative and who used to be a corporate lobbyist, has been lying to the president, has been telling Obama, you know, we've got solid, you know, gold-plated environmental standards, good labor standards. We did the right thing. This is exactly what it should be. I mean, it's impossible to read the thing, you know, because most of it is language like, you know, paragraph 122 of section 16 of law number S34901, enacted in 1954 in USG, the word the shall be changed to maybe, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it's to read the TPP, you have to be in a law library and you need a dozen assistants. It's incredibly opaque. So odds are the president's never even read it. He might be being buffaloed. He certainly, the way he talks, I mean, he talks with this conviction, like this is the best trade deal ever. And so that possibility that he's being lied to by his own staff, by his own guy, by Froman, I can't discard. I lean more toward the cynical. But I think that's entirely possible.
Well, you mentioned it as an ideological framework, the so-called free trade agreement starting in the 1990s. Of course, for the corporations, for the banks, ideology doesn't motivate them. What motivates them is profit, extra profit, super profit, removing any obstacle or hindrance to the free flow of capital, so to speak. But let's talk about ideology, because we see now Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton representing really two different sectors of the Democratic Party. Sanders representing, I feel, a liberal section of the party that's been essentially put out to pasture for the past 25 years and is now attempting to make a comeback. And Clinton representing that old establishment. And you talked about the 1990s, Bill Clinton. I mean, he was the one who brought in NAFTA. During the 1990s, the word liberal essentially got extinguished from the American political vocabulary. It became the L word, not by the right wing, but by the right wing and the liberals, official liberals, not good-hearted liberals.
Yeah.
You had the ending of welfare as we know it, as Clinton said, which took 7 million kids off the rolls instantly. They weren't on welfare or poor because of something they had done. They were just poor. In other words, we had this sort of trajectory where the Reagan era ushered in this big right-wing sweep, and everyone kind of went with the program. And the Democrats, as you said, were acquiescing, changing the political ideology of the Democratic Party. But now Clinton says, Hillary Clinton, no to TPP. Do you feel that even though she represents the establishment, that there's such a groundswell of opposition to what has gone on in the last 25 years, that there's some sort of observable, you know, sort of beginning of a political shift in the political pendulum back in the other direction?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Whether Hillary Clinton will say, I oppose the TPP and then become president and sign the TPP, or whether she'll say now, as she does, I oppose the TPP. Although she's doing it with caveats, she's saying, you know, we can make it better, right? And which, in other words, she's still in favor of trade agreements, or whether she will wake up. I don't know. You know, I don't know how cynical or how calculated all this is. What I do know is that there is a grassroots movement in this country. It is sweeping both parties. It is sweeping through the independents like wildfire to say, enough of this. We want economic nationalism. We want America to be for America. And other countries should be for their, you know, Mexico should be for Mexico. Canada should be for Canada. Economic nationalism is an important thing. It's, you know, and we need it back because it's the lack of it is killing our country.
Thank you, Tom Hartmann. We're talking about the TPP. It's just the beginning of what will be, I believe, a very, very big, perhaps profound struggle in domestic politics, not just here, but in the other 11 countries that have signed on.
Totally agree, Brian. Thanks for being with you. It's an honor and pleasure.
Thank you.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Major news for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. A United Nations panel has decided that Assange's 3.5 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London amounts to arbitrary detention, leading his lawyers to call for the Swedish extradition request to be dropped immediately. We are joined by Kristen Kroffensen, investigative journalist and the spokesperson for WikiLeaks from London. Kristen, what did the United Nations panel decide, and what does it mean for Julian Assange? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Can you envision him now becoming a free man?
Yes, I mean, we hope so. I would prefer to wait for the formal announcement tomorrow morning on the decision by the United Nations panel. But of course, it has now announced by several media and confirmed by the Swedish authorities that the ruling was in Julian's favor. And so we can assume and hope that this is correct. And this is an extremely positive outcome, of course. And what should be happen next, of course, is the dropping of the arrest warrant, and the UK authorities would hand him his act and give him his freedom back.
A Swedish foreign ministry spokesperson acknowledged the findings of the UN panel that Mr. Assange was arbitrarily detained. What would the options be now for the Swedish government at this moment?
Well, if the Swedish government wants to be taken seriously in the international arena, a country that is now campaigning for a seat on the UN Security Council, for example, and has often pertained to be, well, you know, the most important country in the fight for human rights in the world. Of course, they should honor this this decision and immediately drop the European arrest warrant, which led to the situation Julian is in. This is the thing that we expect. It's a natural thing to do. Any other outcome would be extremely shameful and an embarrassing thing for Sweden. It would undermine this very important instrument of the United Nations in the battle for human rights around the globe. It will give up a precedent that other countries would simply disregard this very important panel.
The UN arbitrary detention code is enshrined in Article 9 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It says, everyone has the right to liberty and security of person. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest or detention. No one shall be deprived of his liberty except on such grounds and in accordance with such procedures as are established by law. How does Mr. Assange's case constitute arbitrary detention? We have a U.S. and a global audience. Help the audience understand it.
Well, the problem is that we haven't seen the ruling. We won't see it until tomorrow morning. We only have unsubstantiated reports of the outcome, so we don't know how it's based, the finding. But basically, this is not the only international treaty that is used as a basis for the work of the panel of judges, the working group of arbitrary detention. But the bottom line is that they rule that the situation Julian is contravening of this legal instrument and other international treaties on human rights. So he is illegally detained. That is the bottom line.
Right. He cannot leave. And the UK government also has acknowledged the UN panel's findings. This is as of Thursday. But they are saying that if Julian Assange steps out of the Ecuadorian embassy where he's been granted political asylum, they intend to arrest him. So does the UN panel's decision have legal weight? Does it have the weight of public opinion? Does it put pressure on the British government? How does it play out right now?
I don't know any example in a Western European country where that has disregarded the outcome of this important UN panel. On the contrary, Western European countries have used the decision by the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention in the battle to have political prisoners freed around the world. That was the case with Aung San Suu Kyi, also with the former president of Maldives, etc. If the UK and Sweden decide that they will not abide by this ruling, they are sending a very, very serious signal to other countries in the world. They are basically undermining this instrument. No country in the world will take it seriously afterwards. Everybody will point to the precedent set by Sweden and the UK in the case of Assange and dismiss this panel as being insignificant. That is a very serious thing. That is a direct attack on United Nations and it's the position of the UN in the fight for human rights.
The United States government always or often cites the United Nations as the basis for its own international actions. It did so, say, in the case of the bombing of Libya in 2011 after the passage of Resolution 1973 about the protection of civilians. But here we have a case where the United Nations panel, should it be, as it appears to be, ruling that Mr. Assange is the subject of arbitrary detention, and the UK says, hey, well, we're going to arrest him anyway. And as you said, that would be extraordinary and unprecedented. Is the UK and is the Swedish government under some direct pressure that you believe exists from the United States government to ignore the United Nations?
Well, I would not want to speculate. The only thing I can say is that after observing this case from the inside for about 5 years, it was politicized from the outset, and every step that has been taken has had a political undertone in it, and it has been spurious the way the parties involved have acted. It would not surprise me that there is a pressure from the U.S. We know that there is, of course, a preparation for a prosecution against Julian Assange in the United States. We got the latest confirmation of that on December 15th, a grand jury investigation behind closed doors. So I could only speculate about that, but I want to point out the seriousness, the gravity of trying to dismiss this as a non-significant outcome, if it is in accordance to what we are now hearing. I can remind you that even Obama himself referred to the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention when it found that the house arrest of Aung San Suu Kyi was illegal. That UN finding was instrumental in freeing Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar. So that sort of shows us the severity of this. We have to honor this. Every country wants to have to honor this. And otherwise, you're basically destroying this instrument.
Well, we are out of time. We want to thank Kristen Kroffensen, the spokesperson for WikiLeaks, who joined us from London. We will be back tomorrow. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it must be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.